Anatomy and Physiology, Digestive System and Metabolism, Part 4. This is a beautiful summary slide, even though it's such a simple diagram. It's titled, Where Will the Absorbed Substances Go and How Do They Get There? But the key here is, the big picture is, look at this figure. What we have here off to the right is one villus from the small intestine greatly enlarged. In other words, here's one suction finger from the shop vac blown up really, really, really big. And what's inside of there are blood capillaries where almost all nutrients will get absorbed into, and our lymphatic capillaries called lacteals where our large fats will get absorbed into. And then notice, through these vessels, either directly or indirectly, those nutrients, those toxins, those drugs, whatever we just ate, are going to get delivered from the intestines to the liver. And that's the big picture. But let's break it down and get a little bit more specific. I'm going to show you where your next slide comes from. I'm going to cut out the edge of a villus. So here is my pointer using it like a knife, going to cut out the edge of this villus, blow it up really, really big and slap it on a slide. And here it comes. Here's the setup, because your book, I don't think, did such a great job here. These yellowish cells are the absorptive epithelial cells with the microvilli that line the surface of the finger-like villus. So the villus will go up and around here like a big finger, and these are just some of the cells lining the edge of the finger. Over here, I've outlined with a blue rectangle, this is the lumen of the small intestine. This is where we have the tiny ingredients that we just mechanically and chemically pulverized into small particles, like monosaccharides, like disaccharides, like amino acids, peptides, fatty acids, and so forth. Then over here is the core of the villus, which from the other slide, I hope you remember, the key things in the core of the villus are the vessels, both blood capillaries and lymphatic capillaries. Your book describes how every single thing you ingest goes from the lumen of the small intestine and into our vessels, into our system, so to speak. But I'm going to cut to the chase. So check this out. Here comes on my animated PowerPoint, boom, a little expanding line. And that's the line in the sand, so to speak. Because all the nutrients you see above there, all I want you to know is that those substances are absorbed by processes your old friends like diffusion or active transport and enter into blood capillaries in the core of the villus. So everything gets across except one thing into blood capillaries in the core of the villus. Don't bother memorizing all these specifics over here to the left. That's too nitty gritty. Just know that everything except fats. Big fats are too big to get into a blood capillary. So big fats, technically termed triglycerides, have a special way to get from the lumen of the small intestine across the lining of the gut wall and into the specialized lymphatic capillaries. I hope you remember are called lacteals. Your job, therefore, what I do want you to know in some detail, is how to get the lipid from the lumen to the lacteal. So here we go. It is a big, long, complicated process. It's one of those boring biochemical pathways. It's nitty-gritty that I know it'll kind of go in one ear, out the other, and you'll have to go through it a few times to get it down. The good news is, I think, is I also have it on my plain PowerPoints as a voiceover PowerPoint. I know I don't sound like myself on the voiceovers. I think I was in a coma when I did those. Someone told me I sound like Nicolas Cage. But in any case, you can walk your way through this pathway stepwise on the regular PowerPoints as well. for a quick refresher. I want you to know the bullet points. This is not one of those things where I want you to put all 10 steps in the exact order. But the things I'm highlighting here, the things with stars and underlines and bold and all that stuff and arrows, know these key bullet points. So here we go. Let's say we have a big, large lump of fat that your book calls large lipid globules. I've made it as a yellow circle with a TG in the middle. That stands for our big fats, our triglycerides. My example is going to be a big lump of Velveeta cheese that's sitting in my duodenum. And we need to start digesting that, right? And what might first come to your mind is, okay, well, we're probably going to dump some lipases on the Velveeta cheese. The lipases look at that and they say, I ain't touching that. That's too big. I'm not going to deal with that big lump of Velveeta cheese. Personally, I don't even like Velveeta cheese. We used to use it up north for bait, for fishing, for trout. But in any case, that's neither here nor there. But the lipases look at that and say, that's crazy. I'm not touching that. So look what happens first. The big lump of cheese is emulsified with a star. That means broken up into tiny droplets or smaller globules by our best friend, bile salts. That's right. Bile salts bust up the lump of cheese into tiny globules. I've shown that on this animated PowerPoint by making tiny little yellow circles with tiny TGs in the middle. Then the lipases, you know, mostly from the pancreas with a star. Then the lipases say, okay, I can deal with that. Now I can digest these lipids. I'm a lipase. And it breaks the triglycerides down into their component parts, which you should know from earlier studies are monoglycerides and fatty acids. Then look what happens. After the pancreatic lipases bust up the triglycerides into monoglycerides and fatty acids, bile salts come back again. They do double duty. And what the bile salts do is they form a sphere, a round coating around the monoglycerides and fatty acids. And that sphere of bile salts that surrounds the fatty acids and monoglycerides is called a micelle with a nice purple star. So this emphasizes the point that bile salts both digest and then we'll see help absorb our fats. They do double duty. Notice the double arrows. So here comes the absorption part. The bile salts, once they form the micelle around the pieces, the micelles with a star and an arrow, they carry, like a shuttle, they ferry the contents to the brush border of the absorptive epithelial cells that line the suction fingers that we call villi. And then by simple diffusion, the monoglycerides and fatty acids enter the absorptive epithelial cell. And look what happens next. Look how important the bile salts are. The bile salts are left behind where they can go back and get more pieces of the cheese. They work like a ferry or like a shuttle, and they keep going back over and over and over again. They make round trips, so to speak, from the lumen back to the absorptive cell until they've shuttled all the pieces and parts and gotten them diffused into the absorptive cell. And they're so important, once they're done shuttling, what happens? They're not released into the bowel movements as a whole. They're actually reabsorbed back into the blood, where they're delivered back to the liver, and the liver puts them back into your bile so you can reuse them over and over again. Finally, on this slide, look what happens. Once we get the monoglycerides and fatty acids inside the absorptive epithelial cell, they are actually rebuilt back into a triglyceride. I know, that sounds weird. It sounds backwards. I'm just the messenger. I don't understand why they do it either. But But I just have to tell you how it goes. So once we bust it apart and put it in the absorptive cell, we rebuild it back into a triglyceride. Furthermore, once you rebuild it back into a triglyceride, you must coat it with a protein shell, and that entity, that protein-coated triglyceride, is called a chylomicron with a purple star. Finally, the chylomicrons leave the intestinal cells by our old friend exocytosis. In other words, they're spit out of the absorptive epithelial cell, where they can finally then enter the lacteal. And we have achieved our mission. We got the lipid from the lumen to the lacteal, and it's in our system. To help you with this, I've also inserted a couple of embedded animations from your book that go together and match this. There are two different slides here. Again, I hope they're still working for you. I do understand that links sometimes break down. If that happens, somebody let me know, by the way. Your book tells about how everything in the body gets absorbed. I only want to highlight a few extra things because we don't have to know everything. That's good, right? What about vitamins? I do want you to know about some vitamins. The fat-soluble vitamins are D, E, A, K. Remember, DEEK. How do they get absorbed in your body? Well, they travel in the my cells too. So if I were you, right down below here, just put they get absorbed same as fats, and you have it down. What about B12? B12 combines with our special ingredient called intrinsic factor before it can be transported into the absorptive cell. That's old news. We've done that at least once in this course. Electrolytes, I only want to focus on two here, specifically calcium and phosphate. You need it for your teeth and you need it for your bones. It's in your milk, but guess what? You can't absorb it across your gut wall without a vitamin, and you should all know it is vitamin D, D as in David, with a star. That's why if you look at the jug of milk, it's fortified with vitamin D. Otherwise, you couldn't absorb the calcium and phosphate in the milk. Of course, we have to talk about water because that's the most important thing in our bodies, water. Check this picture out, and I'll tell you the highlights. This says 9 liters, or about 9 quarts of fluids, are dumped into our food chute every day. What's the number I want you to remember forever, though? The average human being ingests about 2 quarts of liquid a day. Remember 2 quarts in and 2 quarts out when we were talking earlier? Well, where's the other 7 quarts come from? It's kind of weird and maybe a little gross if you think about it. Those 7 other quarts come from all our digestive organs we talked about. You get a quart of saliva, 2 quarts of stomach juice, 1 quart of bile juice, 2 quarts of pancreatic juice. We have stomach juice. We have 1 quart of intestinal juice. So all the rest of it's digestive juices. Kind of weird to think about it. What's important here? What's important is you remember the small intestine absorbs almost all the liquid, 90% of it, because the small intestine is the shop vac. What absorbs that last liter of water? It's the large intestine sucks up that last little bit of water. And how does water move in the human body? Never forget it. This is a big picture item. Water moves by our old friend osmosis. That's how it travels across the gut wall and into our system. If you looked at the syllabus, you notice metabolism is on there, and that's chapter, well, I don't remember what chapter it is, doesn't matter. Here's the deal. You should have already done metabolism in your previous A&P studies. So we really don't have to repeat it here. I know that almost everyone listening to this, you already did cellular respiration, right? So who wants to do it again? I'm guessing nobody. So let's just do a brief summary on this slide. What you did in earlier A&P studies is you took the body's favorite fuel of choice, glucose. You put it through glycolysis. You made pyruvic acid. You turned that into acetyl-CoA. You shoved acetyl-CoA into the Krebs cycle, eventually in the electron transport chain, and you made lots of energy, right? ATP. Well, guess what? We could have done it other ways, too. And your body does these other pathways as well, especially under certain circumstances. We could have shown you that, guess what? Fatty acids can also be converted into acetyl-CoA, and that could be shoved in the same exact pathway. And certain amino acids can be turned into acetyl-CoA and or shoved directly into the Krebs cycle. So we could have shown it for the other food groups as well. We just showed it for the preferred fuel of choice, which is glucose. So this is a cute slide mostly just to look at and marvel at. But you've already been tested on this earlier in another course. So let's focus on the last part of the food chute, because we've not gotten the cheeseburger out of the body yet, have we? Let's do the large intestine. Seven basic parts, your book lists off to your left. Don't worry, we'll do them one at a time in that order. But what I want you to get out of this slide is some gross anatomy. Let's say you're doing surgery or an autopsy, or you're on the CSI team or a surgical technician. How do you even know that you're looking at the guts we call the large intestine? Two key features I want you to know about. Check out the large intestine. It looks kind of puckered and pouchy, doesn't it? Well, those little pouches have names. They're called haustra. Haustra means a pouch. The second way you could tell you're looking at the large intestine, besides the fact that it looks all puckered and pouchy, is it has stripes on it. I'll trace on a stripe. Usually there are three stripes on the outside of the large intestine. Kind of looks like racing stripes. Don't call them racing stripes on the test. I'll just laugh a little bit. They're actually called Tinea coli. What they are in reality are bands of condensed longitudinal smooth muscle that are visible right under the clear thin serosa. And again, typically there are three of them that track along the outside surface of the large intestine. Let's do the parts in order. The blind end pouch, that is by definition the beginning of the large intestine, is called the cecum. Recall that it connects with the ileum at a valve that some genius called the ileocecal valve. Also, you should know that in a human being, this is where the appendix is attached. It's a small tubular structure attached to the cecum. Don't look for it in your kitty cats. Cats don't have an appendix. I asked a veterinarian. You may ask, why do we have an appendix? And there's lots of theories. I never heard any really great reasons. But the best reason I heard was a few years ago I read a paper that said, and this was mostly applicable for the old days when there wasn't so many people on the earth, but if the colon got wiped out by some disease and cleaned out your normal good bacteria that are growing in there, the appendix sort of served as a storehouse of normal flora or good bacteria. So in English, the appendix, we think maybe in the old days, was used to sort of reboot the colon with good bacteria, maybe after disease came through the village, so to speak. But these days, of course, we live in such big societies. We're all exposing each other to everybody's germs all the time, so we probably don't have any need to have an appendix to reboot our colons anymore. Very simply, the ascending colon goes up the right side of the body. The transverse colon goes across the body. The descending colon goes down the left side of the body. Then we have an S-shaped squiggle piece of the colon that's called the sigmoid colon. Sigmoid just does mean S-shaped in Greek. Then we have the rectum, which is really just a holding area for our fecal matter. And the anal canal is really the terminal part of the rectum, which is surrounded at the exterior opening by some muscles called sphincter muscles. So around the anus are sphincter muscles, which as an adult we can control. But what about in babies? Those of you who have children know that they do not have the neuromuscular control fully developed at birth of the sphincter muscle around the anus, so of course they get poopy diapers until they figure it out. histology of the large intestines on this slide. No big deal here, guys. Just calm down. All this says is, are the four layers there? Of course the four basic layers are there. They're always there. There's only two things to look at in this slide. The epithelial cells of the mucosa tell you a lot about the function of this organ. There's an absorptive cell with microvilli. Guess what it does? You got it with a red star. It absorbs. Mostly water, by the way. And then there's a goblet cell. We all know goblet cells make mucus. Mucus is to lubricate, protect, and help things to slip slide on out the way. We end here with this slide. The two major functions of the large intestine. And I'm going to simplify them for you. Let's go through it first in detail, then I'll give you my memorization techniques. What's happening in the large intestine? As waste material is passing through the large intestine, water gets absorbed. That is one major function. Also some ions like sodium and chloride, as well as a couple of vitamins I'll touch on. So in English, your large intestine absorbs a little bit of salt water. And in that process, it forms our feces, which may then be defecated. I circle all these top three bullet points, and off to the side, I write up here, the large intestine is a dehydration chamber, because that's exactly what's happening as material is passing through it. The water is getting sucked out of it. Don't believe me? Wait till you see your first elderly patient, maybe in the nursing home, maybe not getting enough liquid, maybe not getting enough exercise and fiber, and poor old Mrs. Jones, she will have a firm, hard piece of fecal matter lodged in her anal canal. And there's a name for that. It's called an impaction. An impaction is a severe form of constipation. And it's so hard and so tightly packed that the patient sometimes cannot pass it. So you will be called upon, like I was called upon to do when I was a med student, to do something called a disimpaction. That's where you will get put on a glove and you will manually take out the hard, dehydrated fecal matter. And you'll never forget that the large intestine is a dehydration chamber. What about function number two? All this says down here is as waste material is going through the chute, bacteria that live there that normally colonize the large intestine, they process the material. In other words, they rot the food. Like if I throw some food out in the yard, bacteria is going to rot it. What happens during the rotting process? Some useful things happen. As bacteria rot the food, they produce some vitamins I want you to know. Some B vitamins and also vitamin K with a star. How do I remember that? Well, when I think BK, I think Burger King. So I just picture a Burger King Whopper lodged in my colon, and I never forget vitamins B and K are made in my colon. So that's the way I do it. You can remember another way. What's the importance of vitamin K? I want you to write it down here. Vitamin K is necessary also for some of our clotting factors. So we can't clot our blood without vitamin K. So one of the first things you'll do if you're working on the newborn baby unit, so to speak, is you will inject the baby with, guess what? Vitamin K. If you forget to do it, they could possibly bleed to death. Give an example. In the old days, some religions had a tradition where they wouldn't circumcise the boy until the eighth day. Why did they settle on the eighth day? Well, they found out if they did it too early, the babies could bleed profusely. And the reason was, at birth, there's not enough bacteria colonizing the colon yet. There's not enough bacteria producing vitamin K yet. And vitamin K is not transferred well to the baby either through the placenta or through breast milk. So we need this vitamin K from our bacteria in the colon. Please don't ever forget that. Also, as the waste material goes through the large intestine, some more rotting and processing goes on, and in that process, proteins and carbohydrates are metabolized. During that process, gases are produced, including carbon dioxide, hydrogen and methane. And yes, they are flammable. And no, your patient shouldn't try anything silly like you see on some of these movies these days. So how do I memorize function number two? All I do is I circle all these last three bullet points and pencil off to the side. The large intestine is also a rotting chamber. So finally, we got the cheeseburger out of the chute, and I hope you enjoyed your studies of the digestive system.